for our city. This is the FC Buffalo Show on 91.3 FM, WBNY. Now, from the WBNY studio, here are your hosts, Ben Tsujimoto and Nick Mandola.
We have a surprise. It's actually Ben Tsujimoto leading off the Football Club of Buffalo show. Nick Mandola has mysterious work duties. But we do have another FC Buffalo owner here, Scott Fraunhofer. Scott, welcome to the FC Buffalo show.
Thanks, Ben. Hi, guys. Definitely not Nick. Happy to be here, though.
But Nick will be joining us a little bit after 5:30 to talk about what's been going on in the transfer window, not just the English Premier League, but some interesting activity today. But, I mean, not a really very active day, but we'll be interested to see what Nick has to say in regard to today's dealings.
And so I'm he's sure not truly gone.
He's not truly gone. Yeah, he's not physically here.
He didn't die.
We'll also talk about the U.S. men's national team's 3-2 win over Iceland yesterday. A good result for Jurgen Klinsmann's men, albeit a little bit scary at times. And, Scott, I want to start off talking about one of your weekend activities, and that's going to see Pippen at Shea's.
Oh, yeah.
And if you could just give us, like, a quick review of what you thought.
If you've never seen Cirque du Soleil and you had an idea in your head of Cirque du Soleil and you're like, what you think it would look like, but on meth, that was it.
That leaves enough to the imagination.
If you're like, hey, Scott, what was the story about? Couldn't tell you. But lots of acrobats and people flying through the air. Physically, super impressive. Some songs, as typically are featured in musicals. But otherwise, you know, don't know anything about it.
I heard there's also a very acrobatic 80-year-old woman involved.
Oh, so I was listening to NPR, and that was actually Priscilla Lopez. And
yes.
To be fair, she was 67. And this was her final appearance ever. In this sort of thing. So she was retiring. So last night was the last of the Pippen run in Buffalo, and that was her final show. So wow. We were lucky enough to see her final performance. And for a 67-year-old, kind of hot. Definitely kept in shape.
A little bit about Scott. He is one of the owners of FC Buffalo alongside Nick Mandola, and there's been quite a few. Scott, what's the ownership status now with FC Buffalo? I know it's changed over the years.
We got a group of five of us. It's been pretty steady for the past 3 years or so.
Mm-hmm. And you've been an owner since FC Buffalo rebranded in, what was it, 2010?
We bought the club in 2009.
2009?
Yep.
A little bit about you. You went to Ken East, correct?
Sure.
Yep. In college, you went to UB.
I did.
All right. So that's a little bit about Scott.
Okay.
The big news of the day in soccer is the announcement that Pep Guardiola, the current Bayern Munich manager, will take over at Manchester City FC of the English Premier League next year. And Scott, what was your reaction to hearing that Pep was going to the EPL for the first time?
Not surprised. I mean, this is something that everybody's been talking about for a long time. At this point, you know, I think City's going to open up the Brinks truck for him, and they're going to make some major signings, and Pep's got friends all over the globe, so he's going to bring in some unreal talent to the Premier League. That said, I'd much prefer he signed with, like, Scunthorpe United, because that's a challenge, right?
Yeah.
You know, like, what does Pep Guardiola have left to prove?
You don't think that he has a lot to prove in the EPL? I think, given his stations at Barca for 5 years, or Barca, as many say, for 5 years, and then with Bayern, he's been at two very elite clubs in leagues that don't necessarily have a lot of parity. And the English Premier League, especially next year, will have, with the TV money, will have a lot more parity. And there's even a lot of parity now with Leicester at the top.
No, you're absolutely right. But I think he's just one of those once-in-a-generation type coaches. He coaches players, sure, but I think he coaches situations. He's one of those really cerebral guys that tells you, you know, where to be at every time, and the players understand that, you know, under his system, exactly where on the field they're supposed to be reacting to certain moments during the game. But that said, Man City ownership is filthy rich.
Mm-hmm.
They just did that deal with the Chinese investors to bring in, you know, another $400 million of just straight cash. So they're going to get the TV money, like you mentioned, and I think they're just going to throw the Financial Fair Play Act right out the window and go to town.
Do you think Pep makes the team a little bit more Spanish? Like, do you think he brings some of his connections whether it's from his just the long time that he spent in Barcelona and then maybe a bit of what he had at Bayern?
Could be. It'll be interesting to see which players follow him over. I know the big name is obviously Lionel Messi.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people have linked him to Man City. So if that happens, I mean, cool. Like, it would be really, you know, there's another person that says, you know, what do they have left to prove? Leo Messi, besides winning a World Cup, but can he get it done on a cold night in Stoke? To be determined. But yeah, you're right. He could bring in some Spanish guys. He's got some interesting Spanish players South American players on Bayern. Javi Martinez jumps to mind. Those guys could jump over and come mm-hmm. along with him and really, really change the outlook of that team and what that team looks like.
My initial reaction to Pep Guardiola coming was a little bit of sympathy for Manuel Pellegrini. You know, he's still alive in all four competitions this year. He won the double in 2013-2014. He's accomplished a lot with City. He has them in striking distance again this year. Do you think it's fair to have some sympathy for a guy, even though he's finishing off his three-year deal and he was offered a one-year extension, turned it down? But I can't help but feel bad for a guy who's achieved and is in the process of achieving quite a bit.
You can feel bad for him, sure, but, I mean, Bayern Munich did the same thing to Jupp Heynckes,
mm-hmm.
And didn't he come off winning the Champions League?
True.
So it's a cutthroat business, and, you know, it's what have you done for me lately? So Pellegrini's storied. I think a lot of people are talking about him going back to Chile and taking over the national team in one of his next jobs, which mm-hmm. would be cool to see.
Yeah.
But do I feel bad for him? I don't know. I guess he's a millionaire. I don't really feel bad for people.
Yeah, that's true. It just seems like he's in a situation where, I mean, there wasn't necessarily a need to replace him. It was a luxury that Pep was interested in, you know, taking this job and trying his, I guess, merits in the EPL.
Yeah.
So that's why. But when I thought about it, you know, it's 3 years of Pellegrini. He's basically lived out his contract. He has won and has the potential to win this year. So maybe I don't feel quite as bad. But I don't know. I'm not a big City guy. I don't know where you stand in terms of City. So I'm sort of, I'm not rooting against, but I'm not super in favor of this happening. And as somebody who is a United fan, a passive United fan, this sort of, I don't know, rubs me a little bit the wrong way. And
Do you think is going to be managing United next year?
I wonder when the Ryan Giggs era will begin, and I don't know if that'll be next year. It probably will be Louis van Gaal at this rate.
Do you think the Ryan Giggs era will ever begin?
I think so. I mean, they've invested a lot in grooming him along all sorts of different managers, right? And I feel like that's still the expectation, is that Ryan Giggs will take over at some point. But it's getting to the point, like, why hasn't he taken over yet?
What do you think Jose Mourinho's next job is?
He's been linked to United, but I don't know why United would necessarily want him, especially because I think the styles that Mourinho and Van Gaal would play, neither of them are really exciting from an attacking standpoint. And I don't know how much of a difference Mourinho, other than potentially a culture change and a little bit more, I don't know, a little more discipline, would be just what would change if Mourinho came to United instead of Van Gaal.
Fun press conferences.
Yeah, fun press conferences. But there's... Jose Mourinho's next stop is, I felt like it was almost a sure thing for a while that it was going to be United. You know, there are rumors of him sending a letter to
a manifesto
to the United brass about how he was going to what he was going to implement when he came there, and that seemed like a guy who desperately wants that job in particular, and I don't know if that's going to happen. Where do you foresee him landing?
It's tough to say. If it's not the United gig, I think he might take some time off and plan out his next move. It could be Paris Saint-Germain. Other than that, there aren't too many clubs that are jumping off the top of my head that have openings. But I'm sure if somebody were to get fired and a team threw a truckload of money at him, mm-hmm. it wouldn't really take a lot of time to make up his mind.
And he's not obligated to stay in England by any means. You know, like he's been around, but I feel like England is the best place for him, like it is for a lot of managers in terms of proving they can excel at the highest level of competition. Would you rather be in Pep Guardiola's shoes or in Zinedine Zidane's shoes right now?
Ooh, good question. I think I'd always like to be in Zinedine Zidane's shoes because he just seems like a very cool guy.
Yeah.
But Pep's a pretty cool guy too. But I mean, Zinedine Zidane is like, you know, top 10 all-time world footballer, hit Marco Materazzi in the chest in a World Cup final, did the Panenka to Gigi Buffon in a World Cup final.
Yeah,
I mean, that's just you know, that's Zidane. But yeah, I've got a lot of respect for both those guys as players and managers. Tough call. Who do you choose? I'll say Zidane. I'm sticking with Zidane.
You're sticking with Zidane? Yeah. I choose Pep Guardiola. I think he has the real opportunity to put his own stamp on City, whereas I feel like with Zidane coming in, he's going to continue a lot of what's been going on. I feel like there was a lot of dislike with Rafa Benitez, and I mean, I can't point to any instances, but Zinedine Zidane is such a beloved name in world football that it wasn't going to be hard for him to endear himself there. I feel like Pep has still room to prove, and it's a good opportunity for him to put his name, maybe not alongside Sir Alex Ferguson, but, you know, in that upper echelon of managers that we think all time, these are the great ones.
No, that's a fair point. I don't think really anybody is ever going to come close to Ferguson, you know, winning the league 20 sometimes.
Yeah.
I know Arsene Wenger's, his time at Arsenal is eclipsed as far as term, but, you know, actual trophies, like, it's going to be tough for anybody to reach Ferguson's numbers. It's interesting though, because I think Pep is a culture guy. You know, he is one of those dominant figures, who is just a student of the game, and what he says goes. Where you said Zidane is kind of ingrained, and he's a Madrid legend, and that they're kind of just going to give him respect as a result of that. Yeah, that's true. But yeah, you know what you said about Pep. That's interesting. He's definitely got, you know, something to prove, but he's also a very driven, very motivated guy. So it would be interesting to see. But I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, City came out of the gates next year and just did something phenomenal.
Mm-hmm. Well, you seem to have a pretty strong background in Pep as a manager. What, I guess, how have you been exposed to how he manages? Like, was it just from watching Barcelona a lot? Was it from something you read? What's your background with Pep?
I'm a pretty voracious reader, so I've read some of the books on him, a lot of the articles when they talk about pretty nerdy stuff, like just breaking down formations. Man, I wish I could cite the website, because I just can't remember, but you're familiar with Inverting the Pyramid?
Mm-hmm.
They talk about one particular game in La Liga where Pep went back to that, and he was basically playing like like a 2-4-4 setup, you know, two defenders, four midfielders, four forwards, and they just smoked some, you know, La Liga minnow team. I can't remember what it was, but, you know, the guy had film and photos and broke it down. It was the most fascinating thing, because, you know, he presented a very good argument with proof that Pep had just gone back and re-inverted the pyramid back to, like, 1930 soccer, and it was so fascinating. But yeah, he's an innovator. So, and he's an innovator with the work ethic to match it. So I think City's in good hands, and I'd put money on it that they're going to have a fantastic year next year. Champions League, maybe not, but maybe. Stranger things have happened.
That's interesting. One discussion that Nick and I have had quite a bit is how much at a big club a managerial role actually means. Like, how much of an impact do they have on a club? How much of it is just being able to deal with the press and massage egos? How much of it is really, you know, changing the culture and pushing things? And there's a decent argument to be made that, you know, at Arsenal, Wenger, but at United and Chelsea, like, is there really a huge difference in who the manager is? And just because naturally players are going to be attracted to those clubs just because of their tradition, their success, their fans, the money, but is there a noticeable difference, a very, very intrinsic difference in who the manager is?
That's an interesting question, and, you know, we don't see what happens behind closed doors, but the bit that we do know about culture with individual clubs, so, you know, Barcelona is more than a club. Barcelona, their culture, their ideals are, you know, family, and that everybody is part of the same system, and, you know, whether you're on the hockey team, which I'm pretty sure Barcelona has a hockey team, but you're still part of Barcelona, you know, that ideal. And Bayern Munich has that identity where they're, you know, big on family.
Mm-hmm.
And they keep ticket prices reasonable for their fans. They take care of their supporters. they take care of their players, and it just seems like Bayern Munich has very similar identity to Barcelona. What is Manchester City's identity?
I'm not really sure, to be honest.
Newly rich.
Yeah.
not that there's anything wrong with that.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see. He's not going into a similar culture like he had in Barcelona and Munich.
That's a good discussion just on Guardiola and Pellegrini. The one stat that stuck out for me about Pep is, do you know in how many games – he's had 239 league games that he's coached. Do you know how many games of those 239 that he's lost?
That Pep Guardiola has lost between Barcelona and Bayern
Munich?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And he's coached 239?
Yes.
How many has he lost? 28?
19.
Wow.
It's just an obscene record. And he has Bayern this year. They're 8 points up in the Bundesliga.
Yep.
A little over halfway to go, but it seems like they're, you know, well on their way to another title. Thanks again for joining us. This is Ben Sugimoto on the Football Club of Buffalo show, joined not by Nick Mendola today, though he will be calling in soon, but by Scott Fraunhofer.
Thank you.
Another owner of FC Buffalo. And Scott, I want to turn to the U.S. men's national team.
Okay.
And this is a pretty fiery subject in terms of even the state of U.S. soccer right now. The 2012 World Cup, some would say, you know, overachieving, beating Ghana. But right now, it doesn't seem like the morale of U.S. soccer is very high at all. What would you, in your mind, where would you put the U.S. right now in terms of where you thought the U.S., where you think the U.S. should be?
I think they're right around where they should be. You know, Ben and I were texting, you and I were texting earlier today about what we were going to talk about. And one of the things I've been thinking about Jurgen Klinsmann is his job as a national team coach. A lot of people hate him. A lot of people say, you know, whatever. He's doing what he's doing. He's getting some results. I think his more interesting role is a United States technical director.
Mm-hmm.
Because we won't really see the results of that position for another 10 to 20 years. So everybody wants, you know, wins, and they want them now. And everybody wants world-class players developed, and they want them now. And it's just not that easy. So, you know, where should the U.S. be? I don't know, right around where they are right now. The type of players that we have, the type of players that we develop are perfect for guys like Bruce Arena, Bob Bradley.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the type of guys with a book on them is they're warriors in the locker room, and they motivate, and guys will run through a brick wall for them, and they will defend, and counter.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the type of players that the United States has developed right now. We don't have your super technical midfield maestros and, you know, your out-and-out wingers, and, you know, we've got good goalkeepers and good center backs and pacey guys up top that can get going on the counter. So
do you think Jurgen is better suited as a technical director or as a coach, or do you think it's fine to have him in both positions?
I think he's better suited as, like, a retired dude that just kind of hangs out and comments. I'm not, like, wildly crazy about him in any role,
mm-hmm.
As far as any role at the U.S., but I don't know. What's he better at? We haven't really seen many returns. If you speak to anybody in the youth game right now, they say it's confused and jumbled, and nobody really, you know, understands what the top-down message is. And if you speak to anybody that's very passionate about the men's national team, you know, nobody really likes him. So, I admire a lot of the things he's achieved, a lot of the wins and countries that he's beaten. But, man, I don't admire his job right now.
And I've also sort of wondered at the people that he's putting in crucial roles, and whether that's Tab Ramos or Andy Herzog or people like that, they don't seem to be quite making, and maybe the U-23s is a great example of a team that's really struggled and has to play Colombia in a home-and-home just
sure.
to, you know, make the Olympics. Do you wonder about his decision-making in terms of who he hires? And I don't necessarily, this is a tough question because I don't know who the alternatives would be, but for me, it just looks like, oh, here's a guy who's been around the U.S. for a long time. He seems like he'd be a good candidate.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, John Hackworth, the former Philadelphia Union coach, mm-hmm. got appointed to, what, the U-17s?
U-17, yeah.
Just after the Peter Novak hazing scandal. So what goes into decision-making or the choices? Why does he choose these guys? I don't know. Like you said, is there somebody better suited for the job? I don't know. But, you know, they do seem like they're underachieving.
Yeah.
And, you know, especially at the U-20 and the U-23 level, it's got to be better because these players, they're not random college kids anymore. They're professionals. They're all professionals.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to see consistency, and you want to see, you know, you want to see wins. Like, you don't want to see struggling for qualification to FIFA tournaments or the Olympics, but here we are in the second straight cycle of, you know, just barely hanging on to a berth.
You made a good point about how Jurgen Klinsmann's impact as the technical director really won't be felt immediately. It will take time. Mm-hmm. And it'll take time to the point where Jurgen may not even be employed by the U.S. national team by the time that, you know, basically whatever he's developing at a youth level comes to fruition. And it has to be frustrating from his perspective to know that he's trying to make these impacts at a very lower level that will hopefully change just the entire structure of U.S. soccer, and whether it's technical or whether whatever ideas that he's implementing, that he may not be able to fully see them through. And in my mind, I think he's probably best suited as a technical director so he can focus all his energies on that. I feel like the coaching and the amount of heat that he's taking, I don't really think those the same player, same person should take those two roles. And those are pretty massive. It's like being the vice president of a company but also being the head coach.
Yeah, it's a lot. And the technical director role, he's trying to make a big culture change. They're trying to change the whole philosophy of how we teach young players how to play and how we get them involved, how they learn the game. And it's hugely different for him, a World Cup winning, you know, German legend, you know, versus the way you and I grew up. So he's trying to bring that here. And of course, you know, there's going to be massive clubs in the U.S. who have great success and are going to look at him and say, no, we've been doing it our way for, you know, since our inception as a club. We're not going to do it your way, or we're not interested in your changes, or, you know, take bits and pieces but not hear the whole message. So he's got an uphill battle the whole way. So, yeah, he's interesting in the technical job, and that might hurt him. As the national team coach, people don't like some of the player selections. People don't like the tactics that he coaches. So that might hurt him in the technical role. People might say, well, you know, practice what you preach. You're not getting results. You know, why should we listen to you? So I don't know. It's a tough sell either way.
His tactics were definitely in question yesterday in that 3-2 win over Ireland. U.S. came back from down 2-1. Got second-half goals from Michael Orozco and Steve Birnbaum. Two guys who you would not expect to be finding the score sheet.
No.
But in the end, it's a decent result for the U.S., and I'll give you some of my impressions on the game. It seemed like a lot of people were praising Jozy Altidore after he lost 10 pounds. He scored a goal. Everybody's raving about Jozy as maybe he's this guy that the U.S. thought they were going to have at the beginning of the 2014 World Cup before he pulls a hamstring and then deals with, you know, an assortment of hamstring injuries ever since and sort of affects his Toronto season. And I think it's natural to be a little bit skeptical of being like, oh, Josie's back. He's going to stay in great form. He's going to be the U.S. striker that they can count on match in and match out. So don't consider me sold, but where do you stand on Jozy? Do you think Jozy will be a starting striker in the 2018 World Cup in Russia?
How old is he now? 26?
26, yeah.
Yes. Just because if he stays healthy, he is in that prime of his career. And if Klinsmann's still the coach, I think he's just going to continue to be the first-choice striker for the sort of style and setup that they play. And just off the top of my head, I can't think of any options that would really unseat him right now. You know, Aaron Johansson's kind of disappeared from the national scene.
Yeah, he's been hurt. Bobby Wood is another one who's kind of, you know, trying to put pressure on him. And he's produced when he's been given the chance.
Yeah. You know, is Jordan Morris, I could probably see on the roster, but is he going to be a starter unless they switch to a 4-4-2? I don't know. I don't see it. Yeah, I think they're going to stick with Jozy as long as his health is there and he continues to, you know, score and chip in at TFC. Yeah, I think he's the guy.
One of the issues that the U.S. is facing is Giassi Zardes and where to play him. And he played as a second striker in a 4-4-2 yesterday in against Iceland, and he wasn't very effective. They played Ethan Finley out wide on the right. He wasn't very effective. They played Lee Wynn in the number 10 role behind the two strikers, and he wasn't very effective. He had glimmers. But one thing that Taylor Twellman said is the U.S. is having a really difficult time finding an offensive identity, and Jurgen has, in not important matches, tried to put players in positions to succeed, but in important matches, he always goes back to the same people he's always called upon.
Sure. I couldn't tell you right now what their attacking identity is. You know, if you asked me to explain it, I couldn't. Like I said, under Bradley and Arena, simple. defend until you die, counterattack. There's still some guys who I feel like that's in their DNA, and they kind of feel that system, or they might play that way at Major League Soccer for their clubs. And it's tough to translate on the national stage, especially these guys that are getting capped for the first time or being involved in the national team setup for the first time. If it's their first January camp, and they're nervous and they're kind of clutching, they don't want to make a mistake. I could see that. But, you know, the other thing is I know zero to I have one factoid. Iceland was the first team to qualify for the European Championship this summer. Other than that, I know nothing about Iceland. So I don't know what their competition was last night. Were they stout defensively? Did they disrupt the midfield? What did they do?
Are you talking about Iceland or the U.S.?
Yeah, Iceland. Did they do anything to make Zardes and Finley kind of disappear? Did they do anything to hassle Lee Wynn?
Not really. They put a decent amount of numbers behind the ball and played the same style that the U.S. would like to play, and that's defend and then counter. And one thing that Iceland did do very well is switch the point of the attack, isolated two of the U.S.'s fullbacks, Kellen Acosta at times and Orozco at other times, and that created chances for them. And they just had a debutante, Sigurdarson, which is not Sigurdsson. Very confusing. They're all very similar names. And he was just absolutely dynamite on the left side. So the U.S. has some issues defensively, but it seemed very singular coming from Iceland, though they did beat Netherlands home and away to qualify for Euros, which is, you know, as much as Netherlands are struggling, they're still, you know, believed to be a powerhouse. I want to run some names by you, and these are center back, I still think, is a position of question. Okay. And I know center back was one of the positions that you mentioned that you felt confident in a Bradley system, but
I'll just jump in right quick.
No, it's fine.
Michael Orozco is a guy I never really want to see in a U.S. jersey again. Ventura Alvarado is a guy I never want to see in a U.S. jersey again. I really want to believe John Anthony Brooks is a potential for the future, but I'm not sold on him either. I hope Matt Miazga is interesting. I hope he has good development in Chelsea or wherever he's eventually loaned out to. But go ahead, name some names. And
you've covered a good deal of my list. Miazga, Beisler, Omar Gonzalez. But let's actually save this question. Our listeners can think about it as we head into this break. Thanks for joining us on the Football Club of Buffalo show. We'll be back for another half an hour after these messages. Welcome back to the Football Club of Buffalo show. This is Ben Sugimoto stepping in for Nick Mendola, who will actually call in and join us shortly. So if you were only listening to hear Nick's voice, which is quite nice, he will be coming on in 5 or so minutes. But we want to touch on a topic that we were discussing before we hit break, and that was on the future of the U.S. men's national team. We already discussed some of Jurgen Klinsmann, but now is the time to really assess the new wave of U.S. talent. And there are so many questions to be answered with this U.S. team. You can look at basically every single position other than Michael Bradley's role and maybe Jozy Altidore's role are up for grabs right now. And this is a time where, even coming up on Friday against Canada, where players can make an impact, we can maybe see the next Bobby Wood, the guy who comes out of nowhere, succeeds in small bursts of time, and then is in consideration for a larger role. And we saw a few of those guys step forward yesterday. Kellen Acosta, Jerome Kiesewetter. You like how I pronounced that? That's pretty good.
Sorry, who?
Jerome Kiesewetter.
He played for
the U.S. yesterday, yes.
I have no idea who that
is. He's a U-23 who's getting a chance to ply his trade under Jurgen, and he played as a right midfielder yesterday. Came on, won a couple corner kicks, was a threat down the wing. He's a tall, lanky guy, deceptively fast, seems to have a pretty good nose for the attacking role.
Where is he signed to?
I believe he is currently on a second team in Germany.
But it's one of those guys.
But it's a Bundesliga second team. So they're not in the Bundesliga. What I'm saying is it's the second team of a team in the Bundesliga.
Okay.
So he's in a good place. And John Anthony Brooks, and while we're talking about the Bundesliga, he re-upped at Hertha Berlin.
Uh-huh.
So there's still that U.S. stamp over there. But
I'm kind of bummed at what an awful season Hanover's having, because U.S. legend Steve Cherundolo was, you know, the Hanover captain for so long. They look like they're going down this year. So R.I.P. Hanover.
We try to get Steve Trundolo mentioned at least once on every show. So,
do you really?
Yeah, I really appreciate you stepping in. Oh, yeah, I'm sure you'd love to talk to us.
Yeah, definitely.
So one of the topics we were talking about was, who do you see as the U.S. center-back pairing coming up? And I feel like that's a question that we really haven't had a convincing answer to. And last night it was Beisler and Orozco starting out, and that while the U.S. didn't face a lot of pressure from Iceland, when they did face pressure, they were very shaky. The first goal, Matt Beisler was a little tentative in going to win a ball, basically headed it straight up. No one around him reacted, and that allowed an Iceland attacker to pounce on the ball and finish. And that basically drew even more attention to the fact that we don't know who our center backs are. So I'll read you off some names. We talked about this before. Matt Miazga, just signed to Chelsea. Matt Beisler started yesterday. Omar Gonzalez left the Galaxy. Now he's going to play in Mexico. Jeff Cameron, who's probably the most internationally, at least in England, successful of the U.S. players. Michael Orozco, who you said you'd happily never see again in a U.S. uniform. John Anthony Brooks, who the jury is definitely still out on. And Steve Birnbaum, who comes in yesterday, maybe a little bit shaky at times at the back, but still scored the game-winning goal and assisted on the game-tying goal. So
yes.
Who among those names would you like to see being that center-back pairing? Or maybe it's somebody I didn't mention.
So a few of these guys I'm not particularly familiar with. Steve Birnbaum was news to me. I know he's an MLS guy. Mm-hmm. Matt Miazga is a very interesting prospect, and obviously signing with Chelsea is a pretty big deal, and people are going to jump on that, expecting him to be our savior. Some of the stuff that I've heard on him, He's technical, good in the air, good ball winner, but the physical battles, he's not really keen on. EPL, Chelsea, that's a very physical league. So mm-hmm. you're going up against some of the strongest, hardest forwards in the world. And if you're not ready to go shoulder to shoulder with those guys, they will eat your lunch. So Miazga is a great prospect. I hope for the best. But Beisler, I liked for a little bit, but I know him and Klinsmann have gone at it, especially after the fitness thing after the camp last year or 2 years ago. So I wonder what his role is going forward. Brooks, I definitely see him in the setup for a while. Gonzalez is he's a big guy. I like his ball winning ability. I think he's super clunky with his feet, though. Like, he's not really technical. I mean, the thing that I'm talking about before with Bradley and Arena is, like, USA just played the most basic 4-4-2, where your center backs were just huffing the ball up the field, right? So you had, your two forwards. One's a speedster. One's a pivot guy who's just going to set up and knock balls forward or knock balls down. And you've got, a midfielder and a defensive midfielder. So your defensive midfielder is playing him cover. You've got a big forward and a center midfielder trying to win balls. And it's like your center backs don't have much responsibility besides intercepting passes, knocking balls out of the air with their heads, and smacking the ball off the field as far as possible. Now that Klinsmann's asking these guys to be super technical center backs, the guys you just mentioned, we don't have that guy yet.
Mm. Speaking of someone who is super technical, we have Nick Mendola on the line, usual host of the Football Club of Buffalo show. He is here to join us. And Nick, I want to fold you right into our discussion about the U.S. And I know you saw the match yesterday against Iceland, and we're talking defense. But Nick, first of all, welcome to your own show.
Hi. It's nice to be on my own show.
Hi, Nick. It's Scott.
Show.
Can you hear me?
Hi, Scott. It's nice to meet you.
Hi, I'm on the radio.
Yeah.
Nick, your immediate reactions yesterday from that 3-2 win over Iceland. We were talking specifically about the defense and about guys who have a chance to make their mark, whether it's Steve Birnbaum, whether it's Orozco, who keeps getting chances. I want to know where you stand in the center back pairing, because for me that's just as interesting as figuring out whether it's going to be a 4-2-3-1, if there's somebody who's going to play striker next to Altidore. But where do you stand with the center backs?
Well, I like Brooks. Largely, he's had, you're pardon the expression, but he's had brain farts for the United States. But it's difficult to dislike him, considering he's, widely tipped as one of the best young backs in a young center backs in a league that's known for producing center backs in the Bundesliga. So at his age, I know he's wanted by Schalke, but he just signed an extension with Hertha Berlin. I think he'll get as many chances as Onyewu did to cement himself, maybe even more chances, given that Klinsmann is German. But next to him, yeah, I like what Scott said about Miazga. I think we've still been waiting for that sort of pairing of Onyewu and Bocanegra that I liked so much. Cameron wants to be a holding midfielder. He's being used that way by Mark Hughes at Stoke in terms of keeping him around. But Klinsmann has shown that he's going to use his best players, his best option at any given position, the way he uses Bradley more advanced, the way he will use Cameron at outside back or at center back, or even slide Tim Ream to the outside. So, for me, I like to think that we'll be ready for Brooks and somebody else, with Miazga being the third guy coming in at that point for the next World Cup.
You might have heard Scott and I talking a little bit about Jerome Kiesewetter, and it was more just to pronounce the name, because yesterday's broadcast crew seemed to do a pretty good job. I've been struggling with it, but you seem like a guy who can say Kiesewetter with some authority.
And I've never heard of him.
Yeah, you know what? He was very good in, considering they didn't win, I don't know if you want to say he was very good, but he showed very good chemistry with Jordan Morris during Olympic qualifying. And so to see them out there together worked. Of course, Morris kind of woofed on a chance that Kiesewetter pretty much provided on a plate. And I would have liked to see better there. But both of those players were far from my biggest disappointments of the night.
What was your biggest disappointment of the night?
Ethan Finley, I thought, was a crime scene. He did a lot of moves that have worked for him in MLS. There's one where he goes to the end line against the left back, pushes the ball around him, which was my go-to move when I first started playing soccer. And I'm not trying to degrade him, but I thought for someone who had been I don't even know if I want to call him the bell cow, but somebody who was very much talked about as a must, well, how is this guy not playing more from the MLS crowd? He was very disappointed. That said, it's his first cap, so I'm not closing the door on him, but he certainly didn't strike a chord for himself.
I've never really been an Ethan Finley guy, and I think he is a good MLS player who will never really find his stride or be a first choice player at the internet.
He's a young Lee Wynn. That's what he is to me.
You know, Lee Wynn was a fascinating figure to watch yesterday because he did really good things and really bad things, I thought.
Yeah, I thought maybe it was that shock of hair cutting through the middle, so you only noticed him at weird times. But I just thought he made a lot of poor decisions, and he's always seemed a bit overwhelmed when pulling on the shirt of the United States. And I was one of his biggest champions, so to speak, when he started really making waves for New England. But, you know, I think he's gotten a lot of chance. But Klinsmann said he's been one of their best players all along in camp. So, and Canada's a team he can do damage about. So I really look forward to Friday.
Final guy to talk about from the game yesterday, Kellen Acosta, playing an outside back role. You know, he's played as a holding mid for FC Dallas, but he's sort of the face of that new wave of talent there. And getting a chance to play in the U.S. men's team, maybe it's not at his preferred position, but how do you think he acquitted himself?
Really well. Really well. Maybe there were a little nerves in there from time to time, and he mishit some passes. But again, at age 20, making your first start, I really enjoyed him. I liked him a bit at the in Olympic qualifying as well. In fact, they just had some big mistakes in qualifying, but he was a player that I really did enjoy at that point. I really look forward to seeing more from him.
Nick, one of the big reasons why we're having you on as a guest is because you have your, you know, finger on the pulse of the transfer dealings right now, and it seems like there's a lot of it's funny because the deadline is not really a firm deadline like you see in the NBA or the NHL or something like that. So things are still unfolding. Things are still being reported. I see Stoke City actually just signed somebody from Porto. Is that correct?
Yeah, following it along, I saw that they signed someone, but I've been reading up because of my U.S. background. Swansea are in talks with Reading over the possible signing of Danny Williams. There's a midfielder for the United States who has certainly had his off moments, but also had a just stunning goal the last time out. And I think there's a guy in his prime, 26 years old, who's going to be in that mix for a World Cup. And I want to see more players playing at the highest level. And the MLS just signed the two-time reigning, or Colorado Rapids just signed the two-time reigning Golden Boot winner from the Swiss Super League. And so here's a guy who we're going to be able to measure as in form coming over to MLS. Whereas Ben, you and I have spoken so many times about Michael Bradley and Josie Altidore and whether these people are keeping their keeping their form when they come back overseas and come back home. Althor, by the way, I heard you guys talking about this earlier, and I just wanted to throw this out there. I know he's not going anywhere here on deadline day, but, you know, scored a nice goal and had a nice assist, and I don't know if maybe I'm a little too harsh on him because I expect more, but his first touch at times is dreadful. Had a couple Willie Mays passes over the top where he just poked them out of bounds instead of having any semblance of control. And we're not talking about bad first touches. We're talking almost non-existent. And I was actually, for a guy who had a goal and an assist, I was pretty disappointed in him yesterday.
He was more threatening, I thought, than I'd seen him in a while. And I saw him play for Toronto FC live this summer. And it seemed like when he was working through those hamstring injuries, the weight that he had added was really affecting him. And I think a lighter Josie, as much as it's like an acute thing to say, like, oh, Josie lost weight, now he looks better, it really did make a difference. He had an extra gear. He was moving better. He was getting into spaces, at least, that I don't think he would have even necessarily made those runs before. So I think while that does make Josie more threatening, I don't think that makes him suddenly a guy who's going to be clinical with his feet. But he did bury his chance in tight quarters and was, you know, pretty crisp in doing so. So I have high hopes for Josie, but, you know, they're absolutely guarded in the sense that he's never really sustained production for that long, right?
He's a big, strong man, and I loved what he looked like running up to the World Cup before he got hurt. So, like I said, I'm hopeful. He's 26, and yeah, feels like he's been around a lot longer. I feel like Scott usually does a really good job of, and I'm sure he did earlier, a really good job of summing up the Josie conundrum. I mean, it's like part of it is, and I think I tweeted about it last night, he is what it is, what he is. That's not a bad thing or a good thing. I don't expect he's gonna take the next step. And at some point, because of the dearth of U.S. strikers, it's fine if he just stays on this level. But I'd like to see better. That's why I wanted, we said it a lot, I wanted Jordan Morris to go to Werder Bremen because the idea of two American strikers playing together with him and Johansson was, you know, tantalizing, so to speak.
It's Ben Sugimoto, Scott Fraunhofer, and Nick Mandola joining us by phone here on the Football Club of Buffalo show. Nick, I wanted to talk to you for a little bit about what's going on in the transfer market. And there were some moves today, but I think it's a pretty quiet transfer window so far. What were some of your reflections, your takeaways, maybe one move in particular that, you know, caught your interest and you can discuss that?
Sure. Umar Niasse today going to Everton for about $19 million. The reigning Russian Premier League Player of the Year, apparently an electrifying force and someone who, in theory, is going to run off of Romelu Lukaku or Romelu. And I'm excited to see that transition because I think the Russian League gets kind of a bad rap. I mean, I don't get to see it a ton, so I'm not absolutely equipped to say that. But these teams are always competitive in the Champions League at some level, and Zenit's looked good too. So I'm excited about that, and I'm excited to see so many of these smaller clubs, so to speak, spending big because of the desperation with the new TV deal to reap the rewards of that and be in the Premier League next year. Newcastle, still trying to get Saito Berahino across the line, then adding Jonjo Selvi from Swansea, adding Seydou Doumbia from the Russian team at Dynamo Moscow, adding Henry Seve, and then across town in Sunderland, they pick up Wahbi Khazri from Bordeaux. So that's what I've liked so much is this was not a window for, you know, Manchester City to sign Wilfried Bony. It was a window for teams to kind of cement their status in a very, very important year. I mean, the teams that survive into the Premier League next year and the teams that get promoted have a leg up on everyone because they're seeing money that no one's ever seen before.
The Umar Niasse signing is interesting for Everton because I'm already getting tired of watching Aruna Kone try to play soccer.
Yeah, I agree completely. He is frustrating to watch.
And you wonder how much Everton can rely on Romelu Lukaku, right? I mean, at some point, even though he's young and stallion-like, right? Like, he's going to break down if he's starting and playing 80-some minutes every match.
Stop it. No, he's not. Yeah. He's fine. Leave him alone.
Just let the man play.
Just let him play. He's good at soccer. Leave him alone.
Yeah, I always wonder. I mean, they're not a club right now that's in Europe either. So, you know, just keep
Nick,
just
they're
keep
in the
grinding.
UK.
Well, I know that's a real problem. European competition, which is different from the Premier League, which is a competition
in
Europe.
I'm just having a laugh. I'm just.
You are a laugh riot.
I'm having a laugh, giving it bifters.
There's one move I heard today that took AC Milan's Antonio Nocerino to Orlando City to play with Kaká. Is there any meaning in that? Like, should U.S. soccer fans be like, "Oh, that's pretty cool"?
I think so, because Nocerino's 30 years old. You know, he wasn't with Kaká a ton at Milan, so it's not a total, you know, out of the blue type thing. A total like, well, these guys are best friends, so they had to be together. And I like to think that Nocerino is a guy who says, wow, look what Seba did. Look what Giovinco did in Toronto, where he was, I mean, almost by far the best player in Major League Soccer. It was like watching Magic, Magic Johnson and Magic the Gathering. So Didier Drogba was obviously dominant as well, and Benny Feilhaber had a nice year. But I think Giovinco having the year he did, in a country where seemingly everybody wants to play at some point, may have brought Nocerino here a little earlier.
Nick, we got a couple more minutes. We spent a good portion of the early section of the show talking about the Pellegrini and Guardiola news, that being the biggest story of the day. And I said initially that I felt sympathetic for Pellegrini just because he's essentially a lame duck coach. He's achieved stuff, and he's in the process of achieving more this year. You know, he's still in four different competitions and can really win a lot, but it's really all going to be for, I wouldn't say for naught, but it's not going to sustain him any further at Manchester City. What was your reaction to this? I mean, I know it was sort of expected, but
yep.
What are your takeaways?
I just think we're in a different climate, a different athletic climate, where there are certain managers who are viewed above everybody else. I respect a great deal what Pep did at Barcelona, and I love watching Barcelona. I do root for them. But we've seen Luis Enrique do it in a different fashion. when you have the best players in the world, it is about being a composer, you know, not a composer, you know, the guy with the stick, conductor. And so, you know, for me, I think it'll work really well for Manchester City. I think it's something that can happen very close to overnight if you do it in the off season. And now he's got time to plan. And also this move, and given Messi's problem with tax status, is the closest we'll ever see, if it doesn't happen, to the best player in the world making a move to the Premier League. So if that Pep makes it happen in any way, as much as I don't want to see him leave Barcelona unless he's going to Toronto FC, then yeah, I think it's exciting. He's a good manager. Pellegrini did a great job, is doing a great job, and it'll be interesting. I think they're still in the running for a quadruple this year. So you send a guy packing after that, it's pretty hysterical.
I rolled my eyes when I heard about the whole Leo Messi to Manchester City idea, and I get the connection, but like, what would you say the odds are that that actually happens?
If Messi leaves, I think there'd be a 75% chance he'd go to City.
Mm-hmm.
That's if he leaves Barcelona. They don't have a transfer.
Yeah.
What's that?
I don't think he's leaving Barcelona.
He's always said he would want to finish his career in Argentina, and he's interested in the United States. But if he were to want to attempt the Premier League, I think I can never remember the guy's name. It starts with an X, and I always murder it. But the connection that got Pep there is the same connection that could get Messi there. So I don't think it's going to happen. But at the same time, you know, if they wanted to cash in on him, there are worse ways to do it.
Do you think that Pep is going to really do a pretty major overhaul at City? I mean, he has a lot of good pieces in place, but you think? What do you think he'll do?
Well, I think Yaya's gone. We kind of knew that anyways. But the sort of players, Pep is known as so demanding, and that he's going to dictate his terms on a team. And if you don't like it, get out of here. He has done a very good job of convincing players who could star elsewhere in Germany, like Mario... losing the name, World Cup winning goal, Mario Götze.
Götze.
I think he's done a good job of keeping those people calm and keeping those players in the fold. So I would expect some of the dead weight to take off. I think he'll do a good job molding players like, you know, their big young center back. And, you know, some of those names that you've expected, you know, Sanya, I think, will thrive under him. think he's the sort of player that can have a very outside back impact the way that Dani Alves did for him at Barcelona and Philipp Lahm is when he's playing right back at Bayern. So, again, I think Yaya gone, Di Michaelis gone, Wilfried Boney could be gone. It's good. Aguero in a 4-3-3, if that happens, is a dream come true. So we'll see what happens.
You know who I think really should be licking their lips after this news is Kelechi Iheanacho, coming off a hat trick this week in a League Cup, I believe, right? Or was it FA Cup?
That was the second one was the FA Cup.
FA Cup.
He had a hat trick in the FA Cup.
Yeah.
Also, some of you guys might be familiar. Just a little bit of breaking news that I'll be writing about as soon as we get off the phone. Irish American international Shane O'Neill. You might remember him from the Colorado Rapids. Last year, he, after going to Cyprus and then on loan to Belgium, he is going to England for the, I believe, the third or the fourth tier with Cambridge United. So for a 22-year-old, that'll be something to watch.
Is he related to Erie Commodore Gary O'Neill?
No, because I don't think he's terrible.
Ooh.
That was strong words from Nick Mandola.
Nick, can you confirm the Shinji Kagawa transfer to Stoke? Is that true? That happened?
I can neither confirm nor deny because I was on the phone with you guys.
Okay, sorry.
Ooh.
I didn't mean to put you on the spot there. My bad.
No, I haven't. No, I haven't heard it at all. But I got Joe Prince right on the other side of the Atlantic, probably covering that. I'd like to see it because I thought he got kind of a bum rap at Man United. I was kind of disappointed overall with Van Gaal recently because I think he's got a heck of a lot of talent, and for it to not be working for him is pretty disappointing.
Nick, since we've got you here from NBC Sports Soccer, or Pro Soccer Talk, this is the last question I have for you.
Okay.
1 minute ago, Stoke City or NBC Soccer just tweeted that Stoke City broke their club record signing Janelli Mbula for $23 million. I don't really know anything about any of this other than what I just said.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you what, I'm really impressed with what Mark Hughes has done at Stoke. They're a team that, you know, has kind of been looked at as they've been a lump it forward type of team, and they've added Bojan Krkić. And what I like about this move for Mbula, who I don't know extremely well, is he can be that I don't want to say destroyer because the man can pass, but a young French player, I want to say extremely young, 23 years old, and he can really spray a ball around from what I understand. So it's not that one-dimensional defensive midfielder who is either lacking in defense or lacking in creativity. I might want to make a comparison off the limited amount of info I know about him to a Michael Bradley, and it'll be very interesting to watch.
Charlie Adam calls him a Patrick Vieira type.
A Patrick Vieira type, so he might be one of the best players ever.
I think it's just because they're both French. But
good news, yeah.
Nick, thank you very much for joining us on your own show, this Football Club of Buffalo show. Thank you for taking some time.
It's all of our shows, guys.
Nick, thanks for coming on the FC Buffalo radio show.
Hey, Nick, quick question here. Derek Kramer here. Before you go, are you going to be one of those guys, and I'll forward it to you guys as well, are you going to be one of those guys that wears a football jersey to Super Bowl football day?
Ooh.
Oh, I don't know if I'll leave my house on Super Bowl football day.
What's this superb owl you speak of?
Superb owl? Yeah. Who? I really want to know.
Strong bird banter from these two FC Buffalo owners here.
If you want to hear some real banter, you should come on a road trip.
You really should, yeah.
Nick, that's it for this chat. Thanks for joining us. Good luck with all your writing for NBC Sports and Pro Soccer Talk.
Did you call me Chad?
Nope, I definitely called you Nick.
I called you Chad.
Okay.
I think Scott called you Chad. Well, this is great. I think we're going to basically put an end to this one. Thank you very much to Scott Fraunhofer for filling in, joining us in studio. Nick Mandola for joining us over the phone. This is Ben Tsujimoto for the Football Club of Buffalo show. We will talk to you next Monday.
Scott Fraunhofer signing off. Free Gucci.